The first reading this morning is from the Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney's play, Cure at Troy, written in 1990, which was his attempt to tell a modern version of the 5th century BCE Greek play Philoctetes by the Greek playwright Sophocles. This part of the play, a poem, was quoted with tears favorably by both sides in the Irish conflicts of the last century, the last decade of the last century. Human beings suffer. They torture one another. They get hurt and turn hard. No poem or play or song can fully right a wrong inflicted or endured. The innocent in jails beat on their bars together. A hunger striker's father stands in the graveyard, dumb. The police widow in veils faints at the funeral home. History says, don't hope this side of the grave. But then, once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up, and hope and history rhyme. So hope for a great sea change on the far side of revenge. Believe that a further shore is reachable from here. Believe in miracles and cures and healing wells. Call the miracle self-healing if you want, the utter self-revealing double take of feeling. If there's fire on the mountain or lightning and storm and a god speaks from the sky, that just means someone is hearing the outcry and the birth cry of new life at its term. It means once in a lifetime that justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. Second reading this morning is a poem by a woman named Dawn Harding, who wrote this in Cook County Jail in Chicago, Illinois, not very long ago. This comes from an online zine or magazine in solidarity with women in prisons.
I woke up one morning to a harsh reality. It wasn't what I saw, but what I didn't that struck me. There was no window to see the sunrise. A thin blanket with no pillow to muffle my cries. The warmth of my home, now lost to this cold, alone in this cell, is where my story unfolds. I'd always been into the partying scene, casually drinking and smoking some weed. I moved on to coke, and then came heroin. I hadn't even started and was already done in. I lost all I had and some that wasn't mine, believing I was all right and everything was fine. Living in the fast lane all those wasted years, so many lost emotions and so many unshed tears. The only way to say how I'm feeling now is, I'm so tired. So tired of it all. By blocking my emotions, I didn't know what I had done. Where happiness should be, there was absolutely none. I'd blocked out the good as well as the bad, and a fantasy created what I really had. I think I want those feelings that I chose to ignore. The harshness of reality knocking at my door. I want to live, and I mean really live again. Say goodbye to this nightmare that I've been caught up in, to get back with my family and to know my son. to give God back my heart and know I'm truly done. See, reality can sting, but it can also fill your heart, mending at the seams where it once was torn apart. I'm ready now to take on life, to give it another try. Come good, come bad, come all. Just please don't pass me by.
On Friday nights, when I was in my 40s and lived in California, I would go across the bay from Oakland over to Richard's house in San Francisco to be with my local family, a Jewish family, where we would celebrate the arrival of the Sabbath together. We would kindle the candles and recite the beautiful blessings crafted by Marcia Falk, and break the bread, and sip some Cabernet from a beautiful glass. And then, since we were what people now call a non-traditional family, Richard, as the householder, would bless me and anyone else who was there. He did this by laying his hands upon my head as I knelt, and he recited a form of the blessing to children, which at the second service the cello choir will sing a version of. In that blessing, Hebrew words meaning peace to you, my child, light on your face, may the Eternal keep you. Keep you safe. Words most often said to children, yes, to bless them. That is, to tell them that they are wonderful, that they are safe, that they are gifted, that they are welcomed, and that they are completely adored. Now, Richard is younger than me by almost 10 years, and I am not a child. But I still often got teary-eyed when he would do this on Fridays. Who wouldn't like to be blessed like that by someone who genuinely cares for you? Rituals that convey love and support are not empty, as some worry all rituals may be, but elegant art forms that actually express reality as it is, or at the very least, might best be. Lots of rituals this week. I did 2 weddings yesterday. You see remnants of those weddings around you, the lighter colored roses and the cranes, the folded paper cranes One couple actually made and folded 1,000 paper cranes, and they were hung in a great curtain here in the front. It was quite an amazing thing. But the most celebrated wedding this week, of course, was the elegant ritual of the marriage between the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, William and Kate. The English royal family is scrutinized like few families are, and their recent decades of family foibles and heartbreak have been merciless fodder for every newspaper in the world. Yet of these two young people who were married, the hounding press could only find every evidence of maturity and a welcome, grounded quality. Ritual, in this case, once again serving to artfully express a reality already well established. And even though these two were not Jewish, obviously, and even though they come from different classes, different worlds, it would appear that these two have both experienced family rituals of great blessing in their days, such as access to every bit of wise counsel, education, and support in their private lives. I love you, my son. I love you, my daughter. Kate herself, nominally Anglican, even has the blessing in her life of a remarkable working-class Unitarian history with the most famous English Unitarians of all, James and Harriet Martineau, blessing her radical family tree growing its deep root in Leeds. Even the press has had to lay off looking for dirt and ways to drag these two emblematic people down, acknowledging that they both have learned from their sorrows, their joys, their doubts, their commitments, and yes, their blessings. Both have been blessed by praise and good education and support. Now, I'm not talking about some mythical perfect parenting here, but I'm saying that both of them have always been seen. They've been noticed. They have not been passed over by their families and their communities. Both have been blessed. As many of you know, it was my grandparents who especially blessed me with the ritual embraces, proverbs, and kisses of an Italian-American family. They told me that they saw me. They told me that they loved me. They are the ones who blessed me, who lifted up my little child's face and shone their light upon it, embracing me tenderly time after time after time. And I know now that their light and their embraces endured in my soul and often got me through the tougher times later in life. In over three decades of ministry, I have met many people, however, who have never had hands laid upon them in blessing, but only in violence. I have met many people who have not had rituals of light and love and safekeeping blessing them, but only curses, criticisms, and demeaning abandonment. I have met many people whose rituals during their upbringing were not beautiful, but the ugly practices of abuse and cruelty and ridicule of all kinds. And I don't think I have to tell you that just as you can't grow roses in a dark basement by refusing them the blessings of sun and rain, so you cannot grow the human soul by refusing it the blessings of love and kindness and depriving it of every ritual of affirmation and blessing, whatever cultural form it may take. And because this is true, we live in a world that many simply call broken. Human beings suffer, Seamus Heaney puts it with merciless clarity. Human beings suffer. They torture one another. They get hurt. The innocent in jails beat on their bars together. A hunger striker's father stands in the graveyard dumb. The police widow in Vales faints at the funeral home. History says, don't hope on this side of the grave. Rough words. Tough. Hard to hear. Supported, however, in detail, by our poet in the Chicago jail, Dawn Harding. She grew up without the reality of blessing in her life, but only the harsh reality of addiction, poverty, distortion, fantasy, and numbness. And then I woke up one morning, she writes, to a harsh reality. It wasn't what I saw, but what I didn't that struck me. There was no window to see the sunrise, a thin blanket with no pillow to muffle my cries, the warmth of my home now lost to this cold, alone in this cell. The only way to say it, oh, I'm so tired of it all. By blocking my emotions, I didn't know what I had done. But then she adds clearly, poignantly, insistently, but I want to live. I want to live. Well, of course she does. After all, she is a human being, not really any different than anyone in this room. She's a human being in Cook County Jail, she says, jailed for substance abuse. But I think it's just as simple and just as honest to say this. She is in hell. After all, I remember the nuns, when I was in Catholic grade school, always harping about how it was foolishly literal to imagine that hell was a place of quenchless fire, the way some describe it, or a place of great cold, the way the poet Dante wrote of it. The nuns used to say, no, hell is not a place. Hell is a state of complete aloneness. What an awful idea that is. Worse than fire, worse than cold, and yet our poet lives there. She calls it reality. She's not dead. She's alive right now and feeling that alone. She is in hell. But for centuries, our universalist ancestors, and remember, this congregation stands just as much in the universalist tradition as in the Unitarian tradition, preached against the idea of hell, an eternal hell. They preached boldly about it for centuries. Yes, they meant hell after death, but they also meant hell before death. Please don't mistake that. And they got creamed by the angry theologians of their day, just like this guy up in Michigan, Rob Bell, at Mars Hill Church, is also getting creamed by his theological critics. They condemn him for preaching universal restoration and justice and love for all, just as we were once condemned for preaching the same thing. Time magazine, many of you saw it, Time magazine just did a cover story about this man, which contained the history of hell. Somehow they did this without ever mentioning us, people who have denied the doctrine of hell for centuries, in this country alone. What if there were no hell, the Time cover asked. What indeed? What if we could find a way to respond to our poet in her jail hell? See, reality can sting, she writes from her jail cell, but it can also fill your heart, mending at the seams where it once was torn apart. I'm ready now to take on life, to give it another try. Come good, come bad, come all. Just please don't pass me by. That's not just an invitation, it's a call, I think. A call asking anyone who hears her voice to not walk past the reality of hell on earth, but to reach in and to help her to resist hell. To help her return to a community where she is blessed, not lost, alive, not numb. She's ready, she says. She doesn't want to live in hell, but in the reality of a community that blesses her, helps her, sees her, and does not hide her away. She puts it this way, she wants to give her heart back to God. Because they resisted the terrible doctrine of hell, our universalist ancestors formed themselves into many communities to do just that. They didn't just speak their theology, they acted it out. And just looking at this issue of prisons, our dreadful penal system, for example, I can bring up several items from Universalist history. I can mention Thomas Whittemore, who gathered communities of resistance campaigning to get rid of the death penalty. Charles Spear, who with his wife and parishioners visited prisons, demanded more humane treatment for prisoners, and edited a magazine called The Prisoner's Friend for many years, enlarging his small community of resistance even beyond the borders of Universalism. In the present day, there is a significant prison ministry rooted in the Church of the Larger Fellowship in Boston, a whole community of folks dedicated to writing letters to prisoners, letting them know that they are not alone. And in our very own congregation, Karen Timmis, who besides bringing blessing, that is kindness and care, to prisoners individually, also works in a few small communities in Ohio resisting the growing injustices in our terribly cramped prisons here in Ohio, many of which are soon to be privatized and associated with the for-profit sector. So resisting hell, no matter the century, basically means banding together to support each other's inherent humanity, even if that humanity has been distorted by terrible circumstances and a lack of blessing. Resisting hell means banding together to dethrone the god called luck. Some people are born lucky, born into homes of blessing. Some are not lucky, born into homes of degradation. Resisting hell on earth means forming communities committed to equalizing these contrasting fortunes as much as possible. To use language that I used in both weddings I did yesterday, to resist hell is to refuse to give either fortune or misfortune any final say. And please don't think that communities of resistance have to be gigantic and fill the whole lawn at the state house to the edge. Don't imagine them as always noisy with shouts and banners. They don't even have to be like the community of resistance portrayed in our wonderful story this morning, with noise-making rituals of chanting and drumming, driving away the great maw that eats the world. Granted, those kinds of community making are indeed wonderful. The Bread Action meeting tomorrow night at Veterans is such a meeting, 3,000 people forming a temporary and exciting community of resistance to work, among other things, for some of the same things our Universalist ancestors did around prison reform, addressing issues of crime and violence in Columbus in a very realistic and humane way. But communities do not have to be vast. Even if Karen Timmis works with two or three, that is still a community of resistance. And right now I'm thinking about other such communities as well, communities of resistance that thrive right here in this congregation. Specifically, I'm thinking today about our OWL program, the sexuality program beautifully titled Our Whole Lives. No banners, no drums, no cast of thousands, not much shouting that I know of, but I could tell you 100 stories about how this quiet educational community of resistance to the dominant culture has set our young people free from the hells of ignorance, reactivity, self-doubt, and shame in the area of sexuality and relationships. I have met so many teens who have come out of this small community of resistance, who go out in the world more self-assured in themselves than I ever was in my life, clearer about their boundaries, and not surprised, not shocked by diverse sexual and gender identities. I can tell you about teens from this community without a single molecule of homophobia or transphobia in their bodies. I can tell you they are self-assured enough to ask questions that a few generations before, none of us were ever encouraged to ask, or worse, were actively discouraged from even thinking about. There are no fanfares about such quiet communities of resistance in our midst, just as there are no trumpets on the cover of Time magazine proclaiming our universalist theology, the one which embodies our complete resistance to hell both before and after death. But the resistance is real, and the very embodiment of the faithfulness that we claim every time we speak an affirmation. Communities of resistance are circles where we acknowledge that the power of one is great and that we can't live without singular, powerful, and amazing individuals like Rosa Parks or Helen Keller or Abraham Lincoln. But the power of many is much greater. And of course, I'm not talking about riots or anything like that. I'm talking about the power of the many, guided not by rage, but by something far more steady, namely hope. And hope is a clear vision of justice and blessing for all. And by all, our universalist ancestors affirmed, we mean just that, everybody. No walking by without noticing, no leaving anyone alone, no abandoning anyone in hell, the hell before death. In Seamus Heaney's words, hope for a great sea change on the far side of revenge. Believe that a further shore is reachable from here. For, he concludes, once in a lifetime, justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. Oh, how I love that line. Oh, for a thousand ways to join together in communities of resistance, small or large, to repeal hell and resist hurting each other. Oh, to bless each other like my friend Richard blessed me, to lay our hands upon each other's heads and shoulders and say, you are wonderful. You are just as human as I am. You can make it. You are loved. The light is shining on your face. I bless you. I bless you. Peace, peace, peace.